Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we're going to be looking back on the five books we read over the past year, which were all science fiction books about aliens, and we're going to be comparing them and analyzing them. Hello, everyone. My name is Caroline, and I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hello.
Today, we're continuing our project on here on History in Reverse of reading and analyzing a science fiction book. And actually, today, we're going back and looking at the five books that we read over the past year. When we started the project, we had a theme, right, Dad?
Yes. Aliens everywhere.
Yes. All kinds of aliens. And weird aliens, specifically, I think, was the goal.
Unusual aliens.
Yes. And so we read Left Hand of Darkness, Solaris, The Story of Your Life, Speaker for the Dead, and War of the Worlds. And if you want to hear more detailed analysis of those books, like specifically individually, check out the other five podcasts on this feed that come before this one. But today we're going to be talking about them in a comparative literature kind of way. I don't know if that's actually a phrase, but that's what I'm calling it.
It sounds good to me.
And I apologize in advance if I get really English major on this. I love comparing stories and talking about themes and things, but we're still trying to keep it at an hour. But before we jump into that, Dad, you have some stuff on the history of aliens in writing, right?
Right. So one of the things that I was kind of wondering when we were starting all this is when aliens first appear, like in stories and literature and stuff. And if you look at like Greek mythology, there's lots of kind of strange beings, but they're all like gods. They come from Olympus. Mm-hmm. There's no notion of people coming from another world. Mm-hmm. Kind of first time something like this occurred, it's called the Great Moon Hoax, which happened in 1835. So this is not really science fiction. It was really just somebody who discovered a way to sell lots of papers. Mm-hmm. So in 1835 in New York City, there was a paper called the New York Sun. Mm-hmm. And the guy who was publishing it realized that if he can sell advertisements for his paper, he can sell the paper to people for very little money and make money on advertisements. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, the more papers you sell, the more you can charge for the advertisements. So around this time, there was a Scottish astronomer, Sir John Herschel, who just had built like a newer telescope. Mm-hmm. And so he was making some discoveries. So these people wrote articles that he discovered life on the moon. And basically they had a series of articles. They sold lots of papers. Mm-hmm. We can put a link in the show notes, but you can look up some of the drawings that they made. So there's these man bats of the moon. And there's like a whole thing, and you could fly in the air. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of a fantastic thing. And I think that was like the first time other kind of beings living on another planet that mm-hmm. occurred.
I guess that's interesting because, I suppose before that, because people knew about other planets, right? The Greeks knew about...
Well, they knew about the planets. They knew in a sense that they were like stars that moved in a weird way, right? Mm-hmm. What does planet stand for? Planet comes from some word in Greek mm-hmm. that means wandering. Because if you observe, you know, stars move a certain way. They just follow an arc. Mm-hmm. Planets kind of go back and forth because...
Oh, because they're like orbiting.
Yeah.
Oh, fancy. I guess because they're also a lot closer.
Right. But they still look like a star because it just reflects light, mm-hmm. but it moves funny. Mm-hmm. And that's why people realized they were different. But nobody thought that there should be a life on them. So mm-hmm. so this was, this moon thing was the first thing. Then a little bit later in the 19th century, there was observations of Mars and people observed what they thought were canals. Mm-hmm. You probably heard about that. Unfortunately, what happened was as people got better and better telescopes, they realized that canals were just kind of optical illusion, and it's just, you know, people were reading stuff into the observations, into stuff that they were seeing. There wasn't mm-hmm. real canals.
Yeah.
But then the whole idea of having Martians.
Yeah.
Or people, somebody, if there's canals, somebody must have built them, mm-hmm. right, and so on.
Well, didn't we ultimately find water on Mars?
Well...
Or we found something recently,
There's something like there's ice someplace.
Neat.
So I think the very first... novel that had aliens was War of the Worlds. Mm-hmm. And this is the first, you know, they come from Mars and invade Earth. So it was also first invasion story, but it was
right.
really the first book
And in that, yeah, in that book, they do see, like, they see the launch come from Mars.
Right.
Through the telescope and everything. And that was actually the last book that we read in our project here. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that people didn't have that idea until relatively recently.
Well, yeah. Well, you have to realize that planets are worlds, right? So,
right.
Like, I have a note here that the thing about canals was, like, 1894 when people were thinking, well, maybe somebody built them. Mm. And, you know, The World was published in 1898.
Oh, interesting. So you think maybe he was influenced by that?
I'm sure he was. Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. I love it. So, I mean, at this point now we have tons of books about aliens. I mean, at the end, I think we're going to discuss what we like about alien books and why people are so interested in alien books. It's stories about aliens, too. But I think to start with, we're going to just go over some broad themes.
Well, maybe why don't we just talk about the aliens from each book?
Yeah.
Right. So the only other thing I wanted to mention is we wrote down the publication dates of each of these books.
Oh, yes, the chronology of it.
And so the time-wise, the first one was World to World, which was published in 1898.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one was Solaris, which was published in 1961.
Okay.
And then Left Hand of Darkness, which was published in 1969.
All right, a few years later.
And then Speaker for the Dead was 1986.
Okay.
And Story of Your Life was 1998. So it was 100 years after World of Words.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's great. So, and then that's interesting, because I think you and I were talking before about the Ansible, the piece of technology that appears in both Left Hand of Darkness and Speaker for the Dead, and Orson Scott Card's other books, and Ursula Le Guin's other books, too, right? So it seems like Le Guin was the one who...
Le Guin, I think she came up with this idea of this loose federation of 100 worlds and having the Ansible as the instant communication.
Mm-hmm.
So that appears in a bunch of other books.
Yeah, and then Orson Scott Card just... Check it.
Hey, you know, it works, right?
Well, it's sort of interesting, like, what kind of pieces of technology become ubiquitous within science fiction, like
transporters it's
tractor beams, that kind of thing.
If you're going to write a book about a federation of planets or something, if the communication takes years, it's kind of, will become very boring.
Right. And communication's a big issue, too, with the aliens. So let's talk about the appearances of the aliens and... For our listeners, you should know we have about an 8-page outline here, so we're gonna try to keep it moving. But I was told to write an outline, and it is I was an English major, so it is quite an outline. So I think we'll talk about the stories in the order we read them, and then we can talk at some point about the chronology, maybe the development of aliens throughout. But I guess the main thing is that we have two types of aliens we encounter. They're the ones that are humanoid. And the ones that aren't.
Right.
So in Left Hand of Darkness, we have the humanoid Githenians, right?
Right.
They don't quite have gender like we do. That's kind of the point. But they have feelings and they have society and everything like that. And
It's almost like somewhat medieval, except with some technology, because, they live on this planet called Winter, which is always very cold. So they're very... well adapted to the cold. I imagine them looking like Eskimos.
Yeah.
And the main character in Left Hand of Darkness is Mr. I, who's the ambassador. He's black.
Mm.
So they always kind of look funny at him because they're not black. They you know, like, they said they're like reddish white or
yeah.
White.
You know? Yeah, I always imagine they were like paler, yeah.
Imagine like Eskimos, you know. Eskimos are like American Indians who just live up north, right?
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess maybe we can hit the ones that have the more humanized. So this Left Hand of Darkness has the more humanoid aliens. And
well, no. So what was the odd thing about them, though?
Well, so the weird thing about them was the gender.
The sex life.
Their sex, yeah. So, and I mean, Ursula Le Guin very much ties gender and physical sex to each other in this story, which, you know, something that may have been different if it was written now, but... Yeah, that they're like gender neutral. They're like sex neutral most of the time, unless they're in...
Kimmer,
right. And in like a particular time of the month, they'll go through a cycle of being either male or female, and then they can reproduce at that point. So why do you think that is? Why do you think that her aliens were more human-like for the story she was telling?
Well, so in the story, remember, in the end, they say that there's some evidence that they were not aliens that developed on the planet on their own, mm-hmm. but they were an experiment by mm-hmm. some genetical experiment. Mm-hmm. Part of the experiment was supposed to be to see if the people and the beings are not either male or female strongly, maybe they cannot have wars.
Mm-hmm.
And the place was relatively peaceful, although they had some skirmishes between the various couple of countries. Yeah, it's not clear that really
panned out. Yeah.
It just, perhaps the fact that the planet was very somewhat hostile to life and they had to spend lots of time staying warm and not dying
mm-hmm.
and freezing to death, we're kind of busy and not having time to fight other people. I guess the point of the book was just to explore the culture, what the culture was like.
Mm-hmm.
If there was no clear male and female, so there was like mm-hmm. no dominant sex or anything like
right,
that.
Exactly. Right, exactly. And then, you know, then how does the human interact with them and right. everything like that? So I think that the aliens there had to be humanoid because, like you and I were sort of talking a bit before the podcast, you know, they had to be able to interact with, like, the point of the novel wasn't communication. The point of the novel was these other issues of, like, gender right. and society,
right.
that kind of thing.
Right.
And that's sort of similar to Speaker for the Dead, where the piggies, so the piggies are, I don't know if I'd say humanoid exactly, they're...
Well, so this is, we go into the Demosthenes classification. Of,
right.
Of,
oh, we have those notes somewhere, right?
So in Speaker for the Dead, and I think this also happens in a couple other books by Orson Scott Card, like in Ender's Game and the follow-ups to Speaker for the Dead, he has this classification, hierarchy of strangeness, and the words from, I guess, Nordic words or something. So it's Utlanding, which is the Otherlander, and it says the stranger that we recognize as being a human of our world, but of another city or country. Framling, the stranger that we recognize as human, but of another world. Raman, stranger we recognize as a human, but of another species. Valrees, true alien, which includes all the animals for whom no conversation is possible. And Jur, the dire beast, marauding, unreasoning threat, monstrous, murdering creature. I should apply that to Solaris, see what that
means. Well, we could actually apply it to all of them. So right. so in Left Hand of Darkness are the Gethenians...
Framling.
Framling?
Philly, right?
Right, the stranger that we recognize as human, but of another world. Yeah. Right, I mean, to the point even where the main character has kind of like a weird like sexual attraction at one point, too.
Right, right. So
the other main character.
The human, Mr. I, is a male, and, you know, the Gethenians actually think of him as being, like, weird.
Yeah, don't they have some Gethenians who have, like, are, like, always one gender?
Yeah, it's like an abnormal kind of a thing that happens sometimes.
And, I mean, so, yeah, I think definitely the Gethenians would be Framlings. Framling, yeah, definitely. So then, Speaker for the Dead, there's the piggies, and sort of the whole part of the story's thing is, are they... Framlings or are they Raman?
No, Raman or Valrees.
Is it? I thought that they talked
stranger
about
stranger that we recognize. Raman is recognized as human, but another species. So they're definitely another species.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
And Valrees is an alien, like an animal.
Right. So, and I think they ultimately come to the conclusion that they're Raman.
Yeah.
So the piggies, physically, what do the piggies look like? Why are they called piggies?
They look like piggies. their descriptions in the book. And actually, there's a graphic novel somebody made of Speaker for the Dead.
Oh, really?
I saw some frames from it. So I imagine piggies more like koala bears than piggies.
With fur?
A little bit of fur, yeah.
I don't remember.
How did you imagine them? Well, they didn't wear clothing.
No, they didn't wear any. No, but it was warm on whatever the name of the planet. Lusitania, yeah. I imagine them as like pigs, but standing upright. And like maybe a little bit cuter.
Right.
Like that's chibi pigs, you know, like little anime pigs. That's kind of how I imagine it.
Okay.
But yeah, they do start to stand upright.
They speak many languages.
They speak. They have a culture and society right. and everything right. like that. So.
And it's funny because the whole big misunderstanding between humans and the piggies also relates to reproduction and sex.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's true. They don't understand the... Because the humans come in with their own understandings of gender and right. apply that.
Preconditions,
right.
Preconceptions mm-hmm. about how you know species reproduce. And, mm-hmm. and here the cycle is totally different,
mm-hmm.
totally bizarre.
And all the evidence is right in front of them.
Right,
and they
but
just
it's just like
miss it.
You totally don't see it because
definitely, communication and perspective are definitely huge themes in Speaker for the Dead.
So I think the one thing the Speaker for the Dead, he kind of think it's like a little cop-out, where the piggies are really good at languages, so they pick up Portuguese and whatever, or Stark, so they can communicate pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
And the humans are not that, cannot actually speak the piggy languages.
There's several they have like the tree languages and stuff.
There's the father's language, mother's tongue.
Well, I mean, that's part of the thing, too, is that all of these things considered, these are all stories that are being written by humans that require certain things. Like, there needs to be some kind of unless your point of your story is communication, which some of these are, there needs to be some like kind of lampshading to be like, you know, oh, yeah, that's called lampshading in any story, whether it's a book or a movie or whatever, where there's like some problem that the narrator, the narration just says, oh, well, this is how it's fine, you know. Like in Star Trek, you know, like, oh, well, the dilithium crystals let the warp core work, you know. It's like, sure, but, like, that doesn't really mean anything. So here it's like, oh, well, the piggies are really smart, so they can speak Portuguese. And that allows the entire story to happen. Right. If they couldn't speak Portuguese, the entire story would fall apart. So those are the two that are the most human. Who would be the which would be the next most human? Maybe Story of Your Life?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So the Story of Your Life aliens are...
So they're not Utlang, they're not Framling, because they're not human. They would be Ramen, right? Because we recognize them as human above other species.
Would they? Do we recognize them as human?
Well, you can communicate with them, right? So that's the...
So I think they start as Verilise, but then become Ramen, right? Because when they first arrive, the point of the Story of Your Life is the communication.
Right.
Right. Initially, they can't communicate, but they learn. They ultimately do learn how to communicate.
Right.
So I think that they would become Ramen. So the aliens in the Story of Your Life are... they don't actually come to the planet in the book.
In the book, they don't, right? They just send like a...
they Skype in.
Basically, they Skype in, the FaceTime.
Yeah, they send a screen down. And they're called the heptapods. They have 7 legs.
Right, and like they're symmetrical. So
right.
Symmetrical, so like they can turn, they can...
They're 360 symmetrical, like all around, they're symmetrical. They have 7 eyes.
So they don't have back or front.
Right.
Which is kind of...
Which has to do with how they see the world. See, get it? It's a theme. So they are individuals.
Right.
Right? They can communicate. They do speak. Mm-hmm. They make noise. They have writing.
Right.
So... In our little human continuum here that we're developing, they're still sort of human.
So they're like Ramen. Yeah, that would be Ramen.
Yeah. And that's the first story we have where communication is sort of a big issue.
Right.
And is sort of the driving... I would say it's probably the A plot. It's the driving plot of the story, is learning the language.
Right. And in terms of being human-oriented, it's interesting that in that story... humans actually get something from the aliens, this perception. Mm-hmm. You know, the language of the aliens gives humans the perception of time, like a different perception of time.
Right, and the main character, Luis.
Luis
sort of becomes less human and more Ramen in that way, right?
Right, yeah.
Because she's now, she doesn't see the world as a human anymore now. She sort of sees the world as a heptapod, or like a combination.
Right.
Because she can't ever be fully heptapod.
Right.
So then the next... would be Solaris? Or War of the Worlds?
The Worlds, it's still more human because they're individuals.
They're individuals, yeah. And they're identifiable.
Right. But they're certainly Valeries.
Yeah, so I think that's a great example. What would they be?
True alien, which includes all the animals. And they live but cannot guess what purpose or causes make them act. They may be intelligent, they might be self-aware, but we cannot know.
Well, but we know that the aliens that invade War of the Worlds are self-aware and are intelligent, because they're...
They have technology, right?
Yeah.
So they might be intelligent.
They're Jor.
They might be self-aware.
The dire beast, a marauding, unreasoning threat.
Well, it's unreasoning threat. It's
monstrous, murdering creature.
It's between those two, right?
Yeah. We got to call up Demosthenes and make her come up with another...
It's like 0.5 of each, you know?
Yeah, because it definitely, like, the aliens in War of the Worlds... definitely have reason, but there's no attempt to communicate with them that we see in the story, at least. They don't seem to make any attempt to communicate with people, and their point is to invade
and subdue the humans. It's do they even give a purpose? Not really.
No.
They kind of eat humans.
Yeah, but they couldn't have been eating humans on Mars.
Right.
So
right.
They're sort of taking advantage of
local food.
Yeah. And then I guess the least humanoid alien is the ocean on Solaris.
Right.
Because who even knows what it is? I still don't know.
Right, it falls outside of this classification because it's...
Yeah, you're right. I don't think it can be classified.
I don't know. Maybe Valerie's because it's true alien for whom no conversation is possible.
Is no conversation possible?
Good question. But it's not a murdering beast, you know.
No, it's not a murdering beast.
It doesn't care about people. It's like...
It might be... We'll talk about communication in a minute. It might be Valerie's.
So the interesting thing about the ocean in Solaris is that I think Lem is trying to present like an alien,
mm-hmm.
you know, a totally not human scale. So this is an ocean that covers a planet,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to have effects on the planet that are beyond physics, that are not explainable.
Mm-hmm.
And when people go there, the ocean does all these kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
and I have a nice quote mm-hmm. about one of the interactions, but... doesn't mean anything to people. It's like, you know, we can assign meanings to it, but is it really true or not? I mean, you know, so.
Yeah. I do like the quote. Do you want to read the quote from Solaris now?
You should probably read it since you're a better reader than me.
I don't know. Every time I read a quote into our podcast, I mess it up somehow.
It's all right. So let me just set it up. So
yeah.
At the very end of the story, Kelvin goes down to the surface of the planet, and there's these formations called Mimoids,
yeah,
which is like a floating island, and he kind of sits on it at the edge of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. And then he interacts with the ocean, and it's pretty awesome. So here's the portion. I sat down on the rough, cracked surface a few yards from the helicopter. A black wave crawled sluggishly up onto the shore, spreading and at the same time losing its color. When it retreated, the edge of the previously untouched rock was marked with trembling filaments of slime. I moved further down and reached out my hand to the next wave. It faithfully repeated the phenomenon that humans had first witnessed almost a century before. It hesitated, withdrew, then flowed over my hand, yet without touching it, in such a way that a narrow layer of air remained between the surface of my gauntlet and the inside of the covering, which instantly changed consistency, turning from liquid to almost fleshy. I then raised my arm. The wave, or rather its narrow tongue, followed it upwards, continuing to encase my hand in an ever more transparent, dirty green encystment. I rose to my feet. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to lift my arm any further. A shaft of the gelatinous substance stretched like a vibrating violin string, but did not break off. The base of the entirely flattened wave, like a strange creature waiting patiently for the end of these experiments, clung to the shore around my feet, also without coming into contact with them. It looked as if a ductile flower had grown out of the ocean, its calyx encircling my fingers in such a way that it became their exact negative, though without touching them. I stepped back. The stem of the flower shuddered and, as if reluctantly, it returned toward the ground, elastic swaying on shore. The wave gathered, drawing it into itself, and disappeared from the edge of the shore. I repeated the game until at some point, like 100 years ago, one of the waves receded indifferently, as if having had enough of the new experience. And I knew that I'd have had to wait several hours to revive its curiosity. I took my seat as before, but as if changed by this theoretically familiar phenomenon that I had provoked. Theory was quite incapable of conveying the actual experience. That's like my favorite scene from that. From Solaris.
Okay.
Yeah, I love that. So that's at the very end.
Right.
And that's like the best way he can interact with the ocean after this
right.
whole experience of
Well,
being
so
there.
What happened in Solaris, though, that in the ocean, mm-hmm. we think.
Yeah. Still not sure.
Created these, you know, formations, as they were calling them, you know, in quotes, which, the way it appeared is that somehow the ocean reached into their minds and pulled out something that emotionally affected them.
Mm-hmm.
And for Kelvin, it was his wife who committed suicide,
mm-hmm.
Harry, and she appeared there. So he had a whole big, terrible reaction to this.
Yeah.
And, you know, she couldn't be killed. She even actually realized that he didn't really want her there, mm-hmm. and she tried to kill herself, and that mm-hmm. didn't work. Eventually, yeah. those things stopped, but it's hard to say why this happened, right? So you can mm-hmm. and say, well, maybe the ocean was trying to communicate with the humans somehow, but it's just like the things are so alien. I think part of the point with what Lem is trying to do is sort of show you something that is so alien that is beyond human understanding.
Right.
And it's totally different scale, and it's, you know, we can kind of assign meanings to it, but that doesn't mean that that's the meaning that the thing...
Right, and I think that the brilliance of Solaris, and that sort of sets it apart from the other ones, is that the point of Solaris was the sort of impossibility of communication, and the very good likelihood that if we as humans ever do interact with aliens, that we will interact with aliens that we just can't understand.
Right.
Right? It's, like, so out there, as opposed to the other stories that were sort of using aliens for other purposes, I think.
Well, so the larger point of this, though, is that when you're writing a science fiction story, you have to make it interesting to humans. Otherwise,
right.
it's going to be boring.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's this thing called anthropomorphic principle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which people say, look, the world is perfect just because, you know, because we are in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it specifically was set up just for us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's you have it backwards, right?
Mm-hmm.
The world just happened to be a certain way, and it gave rise to humans.
Yeah.
Don't reverse the cause and effect.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because people say, well, if some constants in physics were just slightly off, or if the Earth orbits were slightly different, none of this would have happened. That's right, and we wouldn't be here talking about it.
Right.
So there.
Exactly. Maybe we'd be here sputtering about it like the aliens from Arrival, you know,
right.
from Story of Life. So I think basically what we've identified is, I love using the Demosthenes' categorization.
Yeah,
I think that's
that
fantastic.
Works really well. Yeah.
but I think basically what we've identified is there are some aliens that are more humanoid than others. And to me, it just seems like the extent to which the alien is humanoid changes depending on what the point of the story is. Right? You know, Lem is trying to explore the impossibility of communication, like this really kind of trippy alien ocean thing. Whereas, you know, Le Guin is trying to explore, you know, issues of gender and sexuality and
this
culture.
Is actually something that she says in her introduction to Left Hand of Darkness,
mm-hmm.
about what science fiction is all about. Let me just... You talk while I'll try to find it, because I was just...
Oh, one more thing I was thinking of was, mm-hmm. in terms of chronology, the way the aliens developed. So the oldest one is War of the Worlds, and that's when the aliens are... what did we say they were? Between Varalis and Jor, they're
right.
this very destructive... but still very different from humans. And then the most recent one, which is, like you said, exactly 100 years later, is A Story of Your Life. And those aliens are also very different from people, but are sort of the opposite from the aliens of War of the Worlds, because they come to Earth.
To help.
But they come to help, right? So it's kind of the development of the aliens has sort of gone the opposite way, which
right.
is interesting.
So here's what she says about writing science fiction. This is from Introduction by Ursula Le Guin to mm-hmm. Left Hand of Darkness. This book is not extrapolative. If you like, you can read it and a lot of other science fiction as a thought experiment. Let's say, says Mary Shelley, that a young doctor creates a human being in his laboratory. Let's say, says Philip K. Dick, that the Allies lost the Second World War. Let's say this or that, and such, and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think with Left Hand of Darkness, she said, what would happen if the interaction between sexes was totally different?
Yeah, exactly. You know. And using science fiction and speculative fiction as the backdrop for that is
yeah.
kind of the only way to get at it.
Right.
You know, because right. you can't make a realistic fiction where there is no gender, because then you can
well,
start
I mean, you don't want to write academic paper because nobody would read it.
Yeah, exactly. So we've sort of touched a bit. So that's what I think that covers, like, the appearance of the aliens. We've touched a bit on communication. Going through. So one thing I was wondering about with communication is, does the level of communication or the type of communication relate at all to the level of fear the human characters feel for the aliens, or the level of aggression or anything like that? Because I think there are some patterns, potentially.
Well, so like in Left Hand of Darkness, and this is this nice idea of just sending one envoy
mm-hmm.
to a planet.
Right.
right. So that the receiving civilization would not think it a an invasion.
Right. Exactly. Right, so in Left Hand of Darkness, humans send just Mr. I to Geffen to, like, chill out and meet them and stuff.
And try to convince them to join.
Right, and just having the one alien there is not a threat. Then you get something like Story of Your Life. The aliens don't physically come onto Earth. Like, they're in orbit, right?
Right.
But they don't even physically come onto Earth. And in the story, Story of Your Life, the humans don't really feel that, like, they're concerned initially when the screens pop up.
Right.
But they're not really super threatened by the presence of the aliens at that point. And, I mean, the aliens make it pretty clear off the bat that they're trying to communicate.
Right.
You know? Whereas in the movie, Arrival, which is based on the Story of Your Life, the alien ships come down to Earth and the army, like, freaks out. The armies of countries freaks out. But I think that makes sense. It's more threatening to be physically present.
Right, the opposite of Mr. I, right?
Right, exactly. It's the exact opposite of Mr. I. And then you have things like in Solaris. Solaris is pretty creepy. Solaris has, like, a very horror element.
Yeah, I didn't realize that, but Solaris, the action takes place at a space station, kind of above Solaris ocean. Mm-hmm. There's only, like, 4 or 5 people there.
Yeah, it's got a very creepy vibe to it for the good solid first half of the story.
And then some very strange things happen at the very beginning, right? So it starts with Kelvin arriving there as to do his research.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, Solaris kind of has fallen to the backwater of scientific investigation because nobody could figure anything out.
Yeah.
So people finally just said, I'm not going to study this. What's the point?
Exactly. And it's sort of the way the ocean is communicating is, I mean, the ocean is communicating to the extent
They're trying to communicate with the ocean by doing all kinds of experiments, seeing what the reactions might be.
But they're very threatened by the way the ocean's trying to communicate, right? Because, first of all, there's, like, a couple accidents where people die. Flying helicopters
stuff. In history of exploration.
And, I mean, when Harry first appears, that formation for Kelvin, he's terrified of her. This is a person he knows is dead, who's come back, right?
So that's it's kind of ghostly.
Right, and so it's like the attempt at communication is frightening for him. He tries to shoot her into space, and he tries all these things to get rid of her for a while. But, I mean, eventually they manage to talk to each other. I think War of the Worlds is probably the clearest example of there's no communication whatsoever, and it's very highly aggressive from both sides. There's just no communication. And Speaker for the Dead, one of the issues from Ender's Game, which is sort of lingering in Speaker for the Dead, is that the communication with buggers was impossible. The bugger alien race.
Right.
And so the xenocide of the buggers was largely based on the fact that they couldn't talk to each other.
Right.
And the sort of comparing that to how they manage the piggies. So, I mean, I think there's some correlation maybe between being able to communicate and having, like, a more peaceful relationship with the aliens.
Well, partly, like, they didn't try to blow up Solaris or anything.
Right.
So it wasn't threatening. It was just threatening in the sense that we didn't understand what the hell was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, Lem is trying, in that book, he's trying to point out how, you know, the universe is much bigger than people think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like he says, we don't go out into the world, into the cosmos to find aliens. We're looking for ourselves,
mm-hmm.
you know. And in a way, the other books kind of show that, right? The
mm-hmm.
the other aliens are more human, you know, more closer to Raman, right?
But exactly.
Then again, he's right, but on the other hand, it's, a story would be really boring.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I guess that kind of gets to the one of the issues here, which is why do we write stories about aliens, and why do we see patterns like aliens that are humanized? You know, the likelihood of us going out into space and finding another, like, bipedal mammal species is basically zero, right? That's not going to happen.
Right. Imagination is kind of difficult, right? It's hard to imagine stuff that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to come up with something, you have to be very, you know, clever in some ways. I have this theory of art.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have told you this. Art has to be, like, to be effective, art has to combine stuff that you expect and stuff you don't expect.
Mm-hmm.
If there's too much stuff that you expect, it's boring.
Mm-hmm.
There's too much stuff that you don't expect. It's also boring because you have no way to relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be right balance of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And that has changed, you know, like in music and in art or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is kind of similar in these stories. If you come up with these crazy aliens that are totally insane,
mm-hmm. yeah,
and you can't understand them at all, and there's no...
Right. I mean, I guess part of using science fiction and fantasy and everything is that you're creating a space to explore different themes and stuff
right.
in such a way that your reader can simultaneously relate to it, but also be far enough away from it to understand the critique.
And it depends what you're trying to explore. So like Story of Your Life, I think, wanted to explore communication, like how to come up with the, to communicate another language, but mm-hmm. also another species, but also the whole idea that the perception of the world could be different. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, we perceive time and things happen in the past and things, some stuff's going to happen in the future. What if you can perceive the whole thing as just one thing so you know exactly what happens?
Right. And that perspective called for that story calls into question sort of like, what is the worth of a life exactly?
Right.
Like, what does time really give you worth? Or is your life always complete no matter how long it is?
So Lem, at the time he wrote Solaris, he wrote several other books with similar structure
mm-hmm.
where he had presented some weird aliens kind of a thing and that people in it struggled to try to understand and get a little bit of an inkling what it was.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever want to read another one of those books, there's a book called Invincible, which he wrote, which is also very much in a Solaris kind of a
thing. Is it
a
dystopia? Because no. Our next, so everyone knows,
no.
Our next... project is going to be dystopia books.
No, I have a Lem dystopia though.
Oh, I'm sure you do. So the next big topic I think that covers a lot of these books is gender. And so off the bat, we have five authors, one of which is a woman.
Right.
Right? All the other authors were male.
Yeah.
And I think were all the authors white? No, Ted Chiang is...
he's American.
Yeah, Asian American. I think everybody else was white. So, you know, obviously... gender and race and sexuality of the author undoubtedly affects what they're writing about and that kind of thing. And so, perhaps through no surprise, Left Hand of Darkness is the only book that has anything to do with gender issues.
Well, it's also written in the 60s, so it's mm-hmm. 60s was kind of time of sexual revolution.
Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of gender stuff, so Left Hand of Darkness, obviously, as we've touched on, the whole point is sort of, what if... gender and sex weren't
right. So, but the other interesting part of the Left Hand of Darkness was the buddy movie part.
Yeah,
where they did the Mr. I and Estevan.
Mm-hmm. Estevan.
Estevan.
Yeah, when they went over the ice.
Yeah, when they went over the ice. I just thought, you know, the name sounds like estrogen.
It does kind of. Oh, I bet she did that on purpose. So I mean, Left Hand of Darkness directly confronts notions of masculinity and femininity and. She wrote it from, and we talked about this in the podcast about it, she wrote it from a purposefully sort of toxically masculine perspective where she wrote, if you remember, from this narrative perspective of having these like built-in sexist ideas from
right.
Mr. I.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them toxic, but yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
But I think that was the point of
the
story.
That was the point, right, was that he sort of came with this, like, I am a man, and he was like literally the only man on the planet
mm-hmm.
because there's no gender right. or sex. So.
But the other interesting part about the Left Hand of Darkness, that like a relationship developed between the two of them,
mm-hmm.
where it was like almost a love story between the alien and the human,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't go anywhere beyond this platonic love, you know,
right.
kind of just they were
very
really close.
Really good bros.
Yes. And sisters for a while.
Yeah. And then so then in terms of the other ones, I'm thinking like War of the Worlds, I don't think had any...
So actually War of the Worlds had a bit of like the old style sexism where he tries to protect his wife.
Yeah.
She's sent away from everywhere and he, the manly man, he goes and checks stuff out and then of course she gets kind of lost in everything.
Yeah, and then he gets all over the place in England. But it's like the narration itself is not addressing... It's not
right.
asking questions about
that. Yeah, I mean,
that.
This is more like the kind of stuff you expect guys to do
in
the late 19th century. Like, he was helping this woman and her daughter on, a, you know, when they were running away, they were driving some little cart and
mm-hmm.
they were accosted by bandits and he
right.
kind of scared them all.
And he helps, yeah.
Yeah.
There's probably a Story of Your Life. So Story of Your Life doesn't question gender roles exactly, and it's...
Well, the main character is a female.
We had talked about this on the podcast about it. It this is a nitpick because I love A Story of Your Life and I think it's fantastic. Yeah. And I'm not complaining that I have a female main character because it's there few and far between. But Louisa's story does rotate around her being a mother. And she is a linguist and her husband
is a physicist.
The story, again, the when it comes to issues of gender and sexuality in stories, the question is, one, is the story trying to question those things? No, A Story of Your Life is, most of these are not, those are not main issues. The follow-up question is, when it is using gender or sexuality in any way, is it bad? Is it a bad representation for some reason? Is a stereotype for Louise to be sad about her daughter dying? No, because people are sad when their kids die. But at the same time, would the story have been the same if she had been the father? Would there still have, why is it that Ted Chiang made the story about the mom and not the dad? Gary could have easily also learned the Heptapod language. So, I mean, there are questions there. There are questions there, but I didn't think it was story breaking or anything like that.
Right.
And I quite like Louise as a character.
So Solaris had the born sexy yesterday.
Exactly. Solaris had Harry, who was the trope, both born sexy yesterday and some Mary Sue-ness about her.
What is Mary Sue-ness?
So a Mary Sue actually came from a Star Trek thing. So there was a fan fiction someone wrote where there was a character named Mary Sue, Ensign Mary Sue, who was better at science than Spock, a better commander than Kirk, a better doctor than Bones. She was awesome. Everyone loved her. All the men wanted to be with her. All the women wanted to be her. She was beautiful and perfect. And so this trope of a Mary Sue is sort of like an author wish fulfillment kind of thing. I think it's to a point in Solaris in that the ocean is creating this form to please Kelvin.
Right?
So it makes sense that Harry would appear perfect to Kelvin because that's who the ocean is trying to please.
Well, I think you're reading too much into what the ocean is trying to do.
Potentially, yeah, absolutely.
Saying please because the other formation were not pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
To the other members of the crew of Solaris Station. Mm-hmm. And I think the ocean, if it was the ocean, extracted somehow the most painful or emotionally more strongest things.
Mm-hmm.
Also made a good story, right? So this is to make the story human.
Right, exactly. It goes back to that. But she is definitely born sexy yesterday, which is...
So where does that come from? Can you give me some of the examples in stories?
Born Sexy Yesterday?
Yeah, like going back.
I know the main example is the Lilu from The Fifth Element. I've never actually seen The Fifth Element. I know that they cite to that. There's a lot of anime examples.
But is there something from like 40s or 50s or before then?
I don't know. Generally what the trope Born Sexy Yesterday is, it's usually in science fiction, it's usually a female character, though it can be a male character, but it's usually a female character who's sexy. Or beautiful, and may literally have been born yesterday because it's science fiction, but has a sort of naivety about her where the main character, who's like the male kind of normal guy, is there to like walk her through the basics of life. And she does funny things like she doesn't know she has to wear clothes because she just is so naive and she doesn't, she doesn't know basic things.
I'm trying to think of something like Jane Eyre. So mm-hmm. Jane is this governess. She comes. Mm-hmm. She is kind of naive in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And Rochester is this very worldly.
Mm-hmm.
Or some Jane Austen stuff is, where the...
Probably. I don't have enough... I've read Jane Eyre a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I don't have enough knowledge of Jane Austen, but we can ask Mom. Mm-hmm. There probably is. A character that toes the line of Born Sexy Yesterday is Seven of Nine from Voyager.
Yeah, of course.
And the only reason I would argue she doesn't fall into that trope is that she is actually very competent and very smart. She just doesn't know like basic human stuff because she's been in the Borg all of her life.
Yeah.
But she is not like totally helpless. But so that's Solaris isn't questioning gender roles or anything like that, just sort of uses it. So we did left-handed Solaris. Speaker for the Dead. I actually was thinking about this.
It's very, very traditional stuff.
It seemed very traditional. And I was initially holding that against Orson Scott Card, but I wonder if it was to this point. The humans have, like we were saying before, the humans have this very traditional sort of box understanding of gender and gender roles.
Right.
And then sex and reproduction. And because of their very square traditional understanding, they can't understand the pickies.
Right. Totally miss it.
They totally miss it. All the evidence is there, but they completely miss it. So I think in that way, it actually, that story is also commenting to an extent.
Right.
On gender and sexuality in that way.
Kind of found it funny that Left End of Darkness and Speaking for the Dead, like the main source of the conflict was misunderstanding of what sexuality was. Maybe less so in Left End of Darkness, but Speaking for the Dead, it was, you know, I was kind of clever how you was dropping hints along the way. And
That was the second, I mean, I know you had read it before.
Yeah, we read it.
That was the second time I was reading it, and I told you I remembered everything about the piggies. And yeah, it really rewards a reread because you get to see how it was all there. And that's the thing, is it plays on not only the biases and the perspective of the human characters, but of the reader as well, which is the best. So in terms of gender and sexuality in science fiction, you know, the only one here that we have that really directly addresses the issue is Le Guin's story, and it's kind of the main issue in her story. So why do you think it could be difficult to write about gender and sexuality in the context of an alien story? Why is it that the other ones don't really address it?
I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I've read. I don't know. It's hard to probably come up with a way to deal with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in Star Trek, Captain Kirk just, you know, gets the girl wherever she is, whatever color she is, green or purple or whatnot, right? And again, in Star Trek, often happens where the bad alien turns into an attractive woman to entrap the intrepid explorers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it sort of comes down to that issue of aliens being either humanoid or not. Because, like, in Star Trek, almost every alien species they encounter has male and female, unless the point of encountering that alien species is to question our understanding of gender. Mm. And there's various Star Trek episodes where they have, like, three gender species or no gender species and things like that.
Right. Well, in Star Trek Enterprise, remember the Doctor was a thing where family was like three wives and two husbands. So.
Yeah, they were the polyamorous peoples, Dr. Phlox.
Right.
What was his race? Oh, I can't remember. But Denobulan, yeah, yeah. I love Dr. Phlox. Yeah, and so I think, you know, it's part, like, sort of an intrinsic understanding for the reader that there are two genders, right? That there are two sexes. And if, as soon as you create an alien race that begins to question that, that almost becomes the focus automatically, just by it being different.
Right.
So I think that's why, and then in terms of, like, dealing with the gender and sexuality issues of the human characters, again, if you make that part of their character, it almost, like, immediately becomes the point of the story, which I think is interesting. So I don't know.
So, like I mentioned to you before, the book Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Vinge, and in which the aliens are packs of dogs, essentially.
Right.
And they're both male and female. So the way it works in that book is you have to have each individual organism is not really intelligent. But when they come together, they have special communication things, like using ultrasound, so they become a mind when there's like five of them together. They have to be close to each other, and two different individuals can't come too close because they would interfere with their thoughts.
Oh, interesting.
And so there, an individual, a single mind, is not either neither male nor female, because it can have both males and females inside the collection, and they can, you know, make young, and they can incorporate them into their own little pack.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't...
That's tripping me out.
and so that stuff is not really covered or explored much in the particular book, but just this idea is kind of very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so exactly. I think as soon as you start to make your aliens more alien, that's when you get to start to explore these issues. But if you're trying to hit on other stuff and they're just kind of basically humans in space,
right,
you know, then it ends up sticking to the same kind of male-female dichotomy. So another topic that comes up in a lot of these is are the themes of colonization and invasion, and even the relation those two have to each other and the differences those two have. So what is there a difference between colonization and invasion, realistically?
I would say that invasion comes first, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the colonization part is the actual settling portion.
Right.
Yeah. So we have several stories that involve invasion. I mean, I got obvious, the most obvious one being War of the Worlds.
Right. That's just pure invasion and
yeah,
that's it. Speaking for the Dead is more interesting because, right, the idea there is that humans of the 100 worlds found the buggers first and they destroyed them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like being super duper extra careful about any other thing. So they found piggies who they seem to be intelligent. So they want to be super, super, super careful about how to interact with them. So there is a colony on Lusitania, mm-hmm, which is relatively small and super isolated. And only,
well, they think it's super isolated.
True. And the contact with the piggies is very regulated, right? Mm-hmm. So there's only like one or two people who are allowed to go out into the field to talk to them. They try not to do any technology transfer.
Mm-hmm. They try.
And stuff. I think ultimately, though, in Speaking for the Dead, it's like, you know, the barriers break down, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole point is that they rebel against the 100 worlds, and they're saying, you know, we're just going to be piggies / people together and never mind anything else, right?
Yeah, so it's sort of, I guess the question is, like, is colonization in these stories something that's shown as being even possible? Like, is it even, like, is it possible to colonize and not invade? Are the humans living among the piggies not just invading the piggies' homeworld? And then also planting the buggers there. So now there's going to be three species living on that planet.
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting because, right, with the piggies, when they discovered, they become aware of the technologies and stuff that the humans had. They wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same when, you know, Europeans first came to North America.
Mm-hmm.
The Indians here wanted to get pots, you know, metal pots, because they...
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I guess part of the use of fiction generally is to have us think about our own history and everything like that. And, like, I mean, you know a ton about Native American history. I don't know as much. And, you know, the colonizers came. But that was really more of an invasion and a genocide than anything.
To a degree, I mean, yes, but not all at once. It was like, you know.
It was over time, yeah.
It was different groups of people came and stuff, but as opposed to, like, you know, Martians coming and just killing everybody.
Right. Well, we don't know how long it would have taken the Martians to go over the whole world. You know, maybe it would have taken a few hundred years. You know, assuming that they were coming and staying, and that's why they came and wore the worlds. Let's think about the other ones, too. So in Left Hand of Darkness, they sent just the one envoy.
Right, so they're sending an envoy just so that it's not an invasion.
Right, they don't want to appear to be invading.
Right, they want basically the world to join on equal footing, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, so they're not trying to invade there.
Right.
Similarly, the aliens, the heptapods in Story of Your Life are not trying to invade.
No, it's self-interest.
Right. Yeah, they just want to teach the language to the humans. Oh, Solaris. Because the alien doesn't come to Earth. Is that the only one where the alien doesn't come to Earth?
Right.
No, because in Speaking for the Dead, the humans go... So, I mean, so that's another difference. So, which ones do the humans go there? Solaris, the humans go there. Speaker for the Dead, the humans go there.
Right.
And Left Hand of Darkness, the humans go there.
Yeah.
So, none of those are invasion stories.
Right.
One is a colonizing story. Solaris is, like, a science research. Like, they're not planning to stay, right?
Solaris is kind of funny because it's... Lem likes to do... this invent whole histories of exploration. So there's by the time the book starts, it's been like 100 years or so of exploring Solaris. Mm. And at first it was like a sensation. Everybody wanted to study it and stuff. And then none of the research got anywhere. So eventually people said, well, this is not getting us anywhere, so I'm just going
to quit. Such a realistic human thing.
That's right. Yeah, because when you think of academia, right, there's hot topics that people study. Mm. And then if something doesn't go someplace, people just say...
People get bored.
Right.
Wow, I didn't even realize how, like, he is hit the nail on the head with that. That is so human.
Yeah, I mean, that was on purpose. He does that quite a bit.
That's I love it. Oh, I love learning things about humans through reading about aliens. and then the two stories where the aliens come to Earth are War of the Worlds and Story of Your Life.
Right, and you said they were like almost opposites, right? Does one come to destroy and the other one comes to help?
What do you think that the first science fiction story when aliens come to Earth is aliens coming to destroy? Like, of all the things that could have been written about?
Well, I mean, that's how at least Europeans view the rest of the world, right? You know, look what happens when the Europeans did to Africa, to America.
Yeah.
You know, you just invade and grab the resources and enslave the local population and all is good.
Yeah, that's true.
So they're kind of ascribing somehow similar motives.
And I guess like also just the fear of war, right?
Right.
And the fear of
It was
invasion.
Funny because I was surprised to learn that War of the Worlds was written before World War I. But there were some fears of invasion in England from some other countries.
Yeah, there had been wars.
There's always been wars going on of some kind or another.
I mean, that was my thought process. It's just the ascribing the same kind of motivations to aliens as you would describe to your enemy country next door.
Right.
That they want to come and take your stuff, like you were saying, particularly with colonizing. And that's why I thought it was so interesting that War of the Worlds takes place in England, because Great Britain was like the great colonizer of the world, and they get invaded in the story, and then sort of the opposite happens where the aliens die from the disease,
which is what happened to invading Europeans when they went to Africa and the tropics and stuff.
That's true, but also didn't colonizers to the Americas they brought disease with them.
That's true.
And so that was part of the. Right. The genocide of Native Americans, generally.
Right. That's true.
So it kind of... I mean, and
ways.
That's actually an example of like a kind of major kind of lampshading, because if those if the Martians had not died from disease in that story, they would not have been stopped. There was no other way to end that story.
Right.
The author had to end it somehow, and he didn't want to end it with the Martians winning.
Well, it's kind of clever, right?
Yeah. It was cute. So I think it's interesting that the very first aliens coming to Earth story was a very violent invasion, and then the most recent one we have is
I think
let's chat. That's what the story of your life is like. Hey, let's have a conversation.
Right. That's very
very millennial.
Very millennial. Yeah. Very snowflake.
I wonder if they were coming. If they brought memes with them. Heptapod memes. You can read them in every direction. Yeah, so the big questions that I was thinking of that I sort of mentioned in the beginning. What is your favorite thing about alien stories generally? And I don't even have an answer to this question myself yet, so I'm going to think that.
Well, I'm kind of interested in problem of communication, so I'm always interested in stories where the communication is not, you know, let's flip the universe and translate on and meet
right.
Right. So Solaris clearly was one of those. Mm-hmm. This book I mentioned before called Embassy Town has a little bit of that, where to speak in the alien language, you need two people to speak at the same time, because the aliens have two mouths and they speak out of both of them. And to reproduce the same language, you have to use both. What are the alien stories? I mean, like The Story of Your Life was great.
Yeah, oh, I love Story. Because, I think it's my favorite of the ones we read.
Again, this was like an interesting twist on how do you communicate, right? So that's one thing. Like, it's hard to come up with like aliens that kind of work on human scale, and yet are really alien. And there's trying to think what like Borg in Star Trek is kind of like that.
What do you mean, like?
Well, they're not really understandable. It's like this collective kind of.
Yeah.
Although in the end, they bring it to the, you know, the Borg Queen. And,
Hey, I love the Borg Queen.
No, I know, but I mean, it's just, again, it's just like a typical kind of human way to think of stuff.
Right, that there,
why does it have to be a queen? Why does it have to be a central thing? Why can't, you know?
Exactly. I also love issues of communication in science fiction. And, I mean, if you're going to do that, you have to do it with aliens, right? You
can't, well, yeah.
There's not really any other way to do it. So I love that kind of stuff. I think my favorite thing about alien stories is the ways it makes us think about perspective and understanding of the world and the universe, which is one of the reasons I like Story of Your Life, because Story of Your Life deals both with communication, but it also fundamentally questions how we perceive the world.
Right.
Because it's like, what if things weren't linear? You know?
Well, Speaking for the Dead is that's kind of the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like the human sexuality, how humans reproduce, that is so ingrained. So we so assume that that's how it is.
You mean Left Hand of Darkness?
No, I mean Speaking for the Dead, because the piggies, reproductive cycle was just so bizarre.
Right. Exactly. And I love how when you put humans and whatever aliens you've created together, you automatically make your reader have to deal with the fact that the perspectives, it's like everyone's an unreliable narrator and they don't even know it. And it's just because of their perspective and their bias. And yeah, that's like the main thing in Speaker for the Dead, is that they totally miss
and
the connections.
And like in Sled End of Darkness, during the trip on the ice, when she told the same pieces of story from point of view of Mr. I and Estravan. And it was interesting how it appeared, right?
I love point of view stuff. I'm like, if anyone's read A Song of Ice and Fire, which is the book series that Game of Thrones is based on, that's all written from point of view, and it's fascinating. And science fiction innately requires that. Because even if you're going to write an alien species, even if you're not technically writing from their point of view, but you're going to create one, you have to think about, like, well, how do they see the world? You know, Ted Chiang writing A Story of Your Life had to think, like, well, how does a heptapod understand time? You know, Orson Scott Card writing the piggies or the buggers has to think, you know, how do you feel as the last bugger queen in a bag in Ender's tiny room on Lusitania? You know, what kind of things are you thinking about?
On the other hand, it's like if you look at Solaris, let's say, there is no, how does the ocean feel? It's that's just told from the people. Yeah. You know, a human point of view, which is just struggling to understand what the hell is going on.
Mm-hmm. But my guess is that Lem didn't even know how the ocean felt. Cause that's
I know. I think that was the big point. And he does that a bunch of his other stories. One of the things, reading a book about his writing, they said a lot of these types of stories that he wrote is that you present it with this bizarre mystery and your hero tries to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, you still don't know what's going on, but you have a little bit of like intuitive insight about what it might have been, you know. But whatever you think could be totally wrong or not apply or whatever. But
I think that's great though. So that would be my favorite thing would be the way science fiction plays on perspective and requires you to play on perspective. So then the last big question would be, when it comes to alien stories, why do you think people are so fascinated by alien stories? I mean, we have tons. We read 5 books, but there are just hundreds of examples of alien stories, right? And everything from aggressive
to
peaceful.
People always like stories with like fantastic beings. Like go back to Greek mythology, right? There's these superheroes and animals, you know, hydras or whatever, you know, all kinds of monsters, and those are great stories to read, and because your hero has something to defeat.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like an outgrowth of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think it has to do a lot with, you know, having, first, just like the crux of it being having something interesting and new, right? Like you were saying before with art, like it's got to be
a mix of expected and unexpected.
Right. Yeah. And humans are so creative and our minds can go so many places that being presented with a new idea, you know, you could take that and imagine it and run with it and that kind of thing. So, and you sort of need speculative fiction to do that because there's only so much you can
do. Right, that's what Ursula Le Guin says. You want to play with the ideas, so you think of an idea. Well, what if there was no male and female? But
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
What happens?
Yeah. Wasn't there an author you told me about once that said, like, science fiction is the only real fiction? And he gave an example of, like, what if you had a man who was, like, paid in pretzels, and he got his weekly paycheck, and it was pretzels, and he ate it on the way home. And, like, that could only be... You told me something. I'm not making this up.
All right. I don't remember.
I'll see if I can... I'll Google it and see if I can find it. But it's... When it comes to alien stories, I think one of the reasons people are so attracted to it is because the aliens can be fantastic and as elaborate as you want, but at the end of the day, it's the human elements of the aliens that fascinate us.
Right.
Right?
We want to murder.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we want to... We're so social, and we desire so much to connect with everything.
Right.
Right? That we anthropomorphize our imagined aliens. Right? Like, I connected with the heptapods, you know? Like, I felt like, oh, they're trying to teach me a language. I'm sympathizing with that. I think that's, like, what the draw is a lot, is the need to connect with literally everything that we can. And I think that's what's really fascinating about it, is that you can connect with all these things.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I think that should be good for now. Yeah. Do you want to plug your other podcast?
Yeah. So that was Aliens. Yay.
Ta-da. Aliens everywhere.
Aliens everywhere. I do want to briefly plug my other podcast. I'm on another podcast called Unabashed Book Snobbery. It's a Game of Thrones / Song of Ice and Fire podcast. And we have been doing retrospective analysis of the show Game of Thrones. And we do... lots of podcasts. I'm on the ones about the episodes and the retrospectives, and I'm going to be on the podcast coming up. We're going to do a podcast every week for the new episodes of Game of Thrones that are coming out in April, and I'll be on those. And a warning, as our name implies, Unabashed Book Snobbery, we are book snobs. We do not like the show. It's a critical analysis of it and comparing it to the books and the way it's an alleged adaptation and all the ways that it's not a good adaptation. So if you're into that, it's me and a handful of other ladies, and occasionally we get a guy on there all screaming about sexism and racism on the internet. That's what we do.
So our next theme.
Yes.
So for our next theme, we decided to do dystopias. Mm-hmm. We haven't quite decided which one we're going to do next. I suspect...
Brave New World, right?
Brave New World, yeah.
Is that one of the first... What's, like, the first dystopia? Do we have a...
Well, I'm reading it.
Oh, is it that one that you're reading now that you're not so into?
Right. So...
Well, Brave New World's a very classic, like, staple of dystopia. Right.
Yeah.
And I haven't read it in a long time. Yeah. I remember the main plot, but I haven't read it in a very long time. Right. So that'll be one. 1984?
1984.
Yes, okay,
good. Of course.
I love 1984.
And then One by Lem.
And then One by Lem.
And well, we'll figure out a few others. Did you want to do Hunger Games?
We can, if you want to just do the first book. It's quick. Yeah. You'll get through it fast. I like the Hunger Games, and then I like the story, but I have a lot of complaints about the writing and the narration style. But whatever. It's worthwhile to read, I think.
Okay.
And that's a more modern dystopia. And yet, dystopia sort of blew up in the past couple of years, kind of starting with The Hunger Games.
Right.
So there was, like, The Hunger Games, and there was the Divergent series, I think. I didn't read those. The Maze Runner stuff. There's been, like, a lot of, you know, teenager thrown into dystopic government fighting for freedom things that happened. Which is very different than things like Brave New World in 1984.
Right.
Because they kind of go about it a different way. But I think, so that's what we're going to be doing over the next year or so.
Right.
I think our goal is to do, this past year we did about a podcast every 2 months or so.
Roughly.
Something like that.
Life intervenes.
Yeah. So we're going to aim for another 5 or 6, and then we'll do another collective talking about themes podcast, which is always my favorite. So... Okay. I think we're all wrapped up. Thank you guys for listening to History in Reverse. I hope this was fruitful and entertaining for you. And we'll be back starting with dystopias. And I hope you enjoyed listening to us talk about aliens. Bye.
Bye-bye. We have speed. We have recording.
We are recording. Okay, I'm starting my stopwatch on my phone as well, so we can keep track on both there and here. How long is this we're going and it's going to be? If we can keep it to an hour or so, that's the goal.